You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The infancy gospel of Thomas isn't a Gnostic gospel, but it is one of the many other gospels out there that filled a niche for someone. The infancy gospel of Thomas describes the life of the sometimes fanciful, sometimes malevolent boy Jesus. One story has Jesus making clay birds, which he then proceeds to bring to life, an act also attributed to Jesus in the Quran. Then a child spills water that Jesus has collected. One-year-old Jesus curses him, and his body withers into a corpse. Another child accidentally bumps into Jesus and is struck dead. Baby Jesus is not to be messed with. And this is not the only book like this. It's part of a popular genre of books written to satisfy a hunger among early Christians for more miraculous and anecdotal stories of the childhood of Jesus. And for all kinds of reasons, they didn't make the final cut into the canon. But we know from the sheer number of texts and versions in Greek, Syriac, and Latin that it was really popular into the Middle Ages. Now, we don't know who Thomas was or what language it was written in originally, but the stories show a basic unfamiliarity with Jewish life. Scholars put it at having been written in the mid to late 2nd century. So, why are we reading something out of this crazy book that's not officially licensed by Orthodox Christianity? Most people haven't taken the time to even be familiar with the stories that are in the Bible without bringing in more confusion. Fair enough. Let's say you're right. But isn't it also important to see our tradition in a larger context? Maybe a broader background will help us discern a deeper understanding of the finer points of our tradition.
Our words of wisdom are from the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, chapter 8, verses 1 through 3.
And again, after many days, Jesus was playing with other children on a certain roof of an upstairs room, and one of the children fell and died. The other children, seeing this, went to their homes, and they left Jesus alone.
The parents of the dead child came and accused Jesus, saying, "You knocked down our child." But Jesus said, "I did not knock him down."
And while they were raging and shouting, Jesus came down from the roof and stood beside the body and cried out in a loud voice, saying, "Zeno, Zeno," for this was his name, "rise and say if I knocked you down."
And he rose and said, "No, Lord." When they saw, they were amazed, and the parents of the child praised God for these wonders.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
And now, from the home office in Fountain Hills, Arizona, the top 10 list of things that not many people know about Jesus. Not many people know that Jesus, 1, was left-handed. 2, had lost most of his teeth before he began his ministry. 3, smoked a type of cigar made from a desert plant called tujia. 4, suffered from asthma. 5, had a childhood romance with the daughter of an Egyptian prince. 6, shared the same blood group as Judas Iscariot. 7, cured Pontius Pilate's wife of bulimia. 8, spoke fluent Latin. 9, based the Good Samaritan parable on his experience of being mugged. And number 10 sang tenor in his local synagogue choir. John Bell says that the reason that such things are unknown about Jesus is that none of them is true. And when it comes to Jesus, people are always coming up with phantasmagorical facts about who Jesus was, what he did, and what he can do for you right now. Just make your check out to yada yada. It shouldn't be a surprise, considering that this is what we do with all figures that we admire. We all learned that George Washington chopped down his father's cherry tree, and then he told the truth about it. Ah, proof that George never told a lie. Uh-huh. Never mind the whole spy ring and doing president things. So, I wanted to share with you today something they didn't tell me about Jesus, and why it's one of the most important things I've ever learned on my spiritual journey. So here it is. Are you ready? Evidently, in between Jesus being born, big holiday, woohoo, and his death and resurrection, big holiday, woohoo, Jesus had a life. And if it was a human life, which I think it was, he wasn't just God wearing a human suit, then it was a life full of all the struggles, grief, and yes, mistakes that we experience as human beings. Are you suggesting that Jesus wasn't perfect? Yeah. Like the cherry tree for George, the perfect and without sin thing is all marketing by the Jesus for Savior Committee. Now, I remember when I was a teenager having these heretical thoughts and looking around to see if anyone could tell that I was thinking subversive things. If Jesus was human, and people keep saying because of that, he can relate to our deepest struggles because he's gone through them too, then that means Jesus was a jerk to people. He let people down. He did things for which he felt ashamed. Did he feel regret, just like me? In Nikos Katsentzakis' book, The Last Temptation of Christ, he portrays Jesus on the cross, delirious with pain, thinking of the ways things might have been. He could have married Mary Magdalene, settled down in Galilee with a house full of children, could have taught in the local synagogue. Oh, man, what a life. That's a Jesus I can relate to. Walking on water, healing leprosy, not so much. I understand that all of that stuff is supposed to wow me. I get it. But one of the things they didn't tell me about Jesus is how many layers they put on this guy to get him to where they want him. Incidentally, for having suggested that Jesus had had second thoughts while hanging on the cross, Katsentzakis was excommunicated. So don't mess with the script. Case in point is the whole Jesus Christ title. For many, that's Jesus' first and last name with the middle initial H. When in biblical usage, Jesus is the Greek form of the name he actually would have used, which was Yeshua or Joshua. And Christ is a Greek version of the Hebrew title for Messiah, one who has been anointed. And there are more than just one Messiah in Hebrew scripture, including Cyrus, the king of Persia. That's right. the ruler of Iran, honored by Jews as the Messiah. It's in the Bible. So another thing they didn't tell me about Jesus was to keep the names Jesus and Christ separate. In fact, it's been helpful for me to think of the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith to be two completely different things. Anytime I'm talking about the pre-crucifixion Galilean, I use Jesus. But anything resurrection and after is Christ. People get this mixed up all the time. Speaking of the Christ child in the manger, or sensing Jesus in the eyes of the poor, when I think it's much more helpful for me to say that it's Jesus in the manger and the Christ spirit in the eyes of the poor. Our passage today is from a book that early on gets these two mixed up. The whole reason the book exists is to try to beef up the number of miracle stories attributed to Jesus in order to make his life more impressive. And in many of these stories, make Jesus a character not to be messed with. You didn't get out of my way. Bam, you're dead. Notice that even the little child who is resuscitated recognizes and calls Jesus Lord. And you think your six-year-old thought they were the center of the universe. We've already talked about how the titles King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and Prince of Peace are actually titles for Caesar adopted by early Christians. According to Jesus scholar Dom Crossan, if Jesus was going to compete with Caesar, he was going to need a variety of upgrades. Now, it doesn't even take looking very hard to see those upgrades being installed right in front of us as we read the New Testament. Our earliest New Testament writer, Paul, says that Jesus is born of a woman, mentioning this specifically to assure his readers of Jesus' humanity. And Mark, our earliest canonical gospel, doesn't even mention the birth of Jesus. Most scholars believe it was because when Mark was written, no one had come up with the miraculous birth stories yet. Matthew and Luke up the ante with virgin birth stories with supernatural flourishes of angels and stars. Well, that's not good enough for John. So he places Jesus as a cosmic being present before time who is an integral part of creation itself. So in the course of just a generation, Jesus goes from humble human to cosmic creator. And once you start seeing those things, you see it everywhere. The New Testament is full of what appears to be sincere efforts to give Jesus the upper hand when having to compete with the gods of the Roman Empire. Case in point is the lovely story of the wedding in Cana. It's one of those stories that appears only in John, so very late in the tradition. Edward Kessler is just one scholar who has noted that in late 1st and the 2nd century, there might have been a direct rivalry between the Roman cult of Dionysus, the god of wine, and early Christianity. Professor of New Testament Peter Wick has suggested that Jesus turning water into wine at Cana was a story intended to show that Jesus was on the same footing with his pagan counterpart, Dionysus. One of the preset stops on most every pilgrimage to the Holy Land is a trip to Cana. Never mind that there are over 7 sites that claim to be the real Cana, and that the story is just a story. The tour guides have arrangements with all the shopkeepers selling Cana wine to bring in the tourists. So off we go. On our 2011 trip to the Holy Land, I asked our guide if there was any chance of stopping at Sepphoris, a recent excavation of the former Roman capital in Galilee. Nope, he said. Nothing there but the excavated city. And no gift shops. Ah! Never mind that just 4 miles over the hill from Sepphoris is a little village called Nazareth. And during Jesus' childhood and young adulthood, it was being rebuilt as the capital of Galilee. So, guess where Joseph and his son Jesus, local contractors, would have probably worked. Fortunately, on our 2019 trip, we were able to go to Sepphoris, the site where the laborer Jesus, the stoneworker Jesus, the one who was like us, probably really worked. And Cana, the place where Jesus never was and that was created solely to reinforce Jesus' one-upsmanship of Dionysus, and that has much better gift shops, we skipped. The early church took hundreds of years of argument, councils, suspicious deaths, and compromise to finally arrive at the canon and the creeds that, for some, defined Orthodox Christology. But it's not over. It's never been close to over. It continues to change and develop. So, on top of obscuring Jesus' life with stories and titles to polish his reputation, another thing that I just didn't get is that the Jesus of my youth and young adulthood is just my snapshot of someone else's snapshot. Truth? Fact? We don't know. But we've got stories that we have collectively passed down that convey certain things about what we think is the best of what it means to be human. And the person showing us that truth is the very human Jesus. But there are a lot of gatekeepers out there, a lot of churches working to convince people that there's just one way of understanding Jesus and that they've got it figured out. But the thing we call Christianity and the figure we know as Jesus have never, ever been static anywhere. And when Jeff Proctor Murphy and I were developing Living the Questions, one of our chapters became The Lives of Jesus, because it's not just one life portrayed in the Gospels. And the story is evolving still. And if we're worth our salt as followers of Jesus, so should we. If you still believe spiritually what you believed when you were 10 years old, you're not doing it right. Yeah, I know. Old ideas die hard, but die they must. Everything we know about Jesus, about Christianity, and about the world we live in is in a constant state of change, and so are we. Look at all the different portrayals of Jesus alone. We need to forget the idol of certainty and embrace a search for wisdom that sees our story in a broader context and adapts to new circumstances and information, just like Christianity has always done. But for most of us, our span of life is just too short to see the slow change that occurs over centuries. In 1912, meteorologist Alfred Wegener described what he called continental drift, kicking off a bitter 50-year debate in the scientific community. Evidence for the idea came not only from the way South America's East Coast and Africa's West Coast kind of fit together, but from the matching rock formations and fossils along these coastlines. In the 1950s, geologist Charles Hapgood published a book mocking the idea that continents were in motion. Bill Bryson writes, in a tone that all but invited the reader to join him in a tolerant chuckle, Hapgood observed that a few gullible souls had noticed an apparent correspondence in shape between certain continents. As late as the 1970s, the scientific community rejected plate tectonics as ridiculous, and as evidence that even the smartest among us can sometimes get it wrong, the glowing foreword to Hapgood's book, mocking plate tectonics, was penned by none other than Albert Einstein. But guess what? They were all wrong. Plate tectonics is now accepted as one of the primary phenomena affecting most of life on Earth. And to think that it's only been acknowledged in the last 40 or 50 years is mind-blowing. So, we now know that all of the continents used to be joined together in one supercontinent called Pangaea, and that in the future, they're likely to all become one again. We also know, at least for today, that the cosmos is over 13.7 billion years old, and that the Earth is over 4 billion years old. Got that? And everything we know about little old Judaism and Christianity has taken place when? In just the last 3,000 years. Yikes. On the grand scale of things, I think we could afford to be a little humble. Whatever we do, Marcus Borg suggests that we model our following of Jesus on the way Jesus lived his very human life. Centered in spirit and wisdom, centered in compassion and justice, to listen to and respond to the deep yearnings within most human beings, the yearning for a fuller connection to life, to reality, to the mystery of the sacred, a fuller engagement with others, and to strive to make the world a better place. So, I guess there's a lot that they didn't tell me about Jesus. And what I've discovered is that that's okay. Learning to discern for myself what makes sense and what doesn't has, in fact, been the story of my spiritual journey. In the end, it's about striving through all the obstructions to see and emulate the human being Jesus and to genuinely see the presence of Christ in those around me. If you know deep down that yearning to be the best you can be and for the world to be a better place, don't be discouraged by those who don't understand you, but who claim to have all the answers. Know that as we focus on loving kindness, doing justice, and walking humbly, we are essentially on the same path with Jesus. And doing those things are one of the things they did tell me about Jesus. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.fountains.org. weputlovefirst.org.